everyone. My name is Amanda Hito Murphy. I'm the gallery director here at Hamiltonian. Thank you so much for sharing your evening with us this evening. We are here, of course, to see a presentation by the two artists who are showing in this space, Ms. Rachel Cordiola and Mr. Kyle Peda, who are sitting right here. I always have to do this. I have to do the proud mom introduction to the artists, and I promise that I will embarrass you thoroughly. So, Rachel Cordiola is a 2017 Hamiltonian Fellow, or 2016, sorry. And the last time that we spoke with her, I'm not sure if some of you were in the audience, but she was wearing a hazmat suit and a respirator. And she was basically doing a performance of sorts as an explorer in an unknown corner of the universe, a terra incognita, if you will. Now, Rachel was actually speaking to us from Iceland after having participated in the 2016 Arctic Circle Art and Science Expedition, which was a residency that brings together artists and scientists on board a barkentine ship for a period of 3 weeks to create work and exchange ideas. So basically, she was in the tall ship in the middle of the Arctic Ocean. So a lady who definitely is not afraid to take some huge risks. Rachel has traveled extensively throughout her art career to date, and I think that this worldly perspective is absolutely reflected in the installation that she's presenting here, Transmission from Terra Incognita. She will be sharing with us material from her travels to the Arctic, among other things, and this is her first solo presentation at Hamiltonian, so we're excited to see where she takes us next. Congratulations, Rachel. Now, Kyle Tata, meanwhile, is a 2015 fellow, and this is his last focus show with us. And I get nostalgic at times like this because it does feel like just yesterday that I was asking Kyle in the first artist talk he ever gave here what kind of cookie he would be if he were a cookie. And he answered that question by saying he'd be a gingerbread man because they're goofy and personable. And while I would say that that is absolutely true, what's better yet is that when you work with a gingerbread man of an artist, they're personable and fun, but the fact is that Kyle also makes really, really fantastic work, and so it's rare that you get that full package, and it's been a blast to work with him. What I think is truly special about Kyle, yes, this is where I get to be the gooey, like, embarrassing mom, is that he really, really loves art. I remember that we went to Untitled Art Fair during Art Basel Miami Beach, and Kyle and his lovely girlfriend Claire, who is sitting in the audience here, we all walked through Untitled Art Fair together, and they spent 3 full hours in this presentation, which, if you've gone down for any art fair, most people can only ever stomach about 30 minutes and then they're done. But Kyle spent the full 3 hours with Claire, and I remember them looking meticulously at absolutely everything. I remember being struck by the fact that Kyle recognized quite a few of the artists, if not all of them, both young and old. It didn't matter if the artist was a big deal in the 50s or if they were the hot new thing. Kyle knew them by name, and he was able to just kind of spout out and look like, oh, that's this person. But it came from a very genuine place of interest. And I feel like every time I've gone to do a studio visit with Kyle, he's reading a new book, he's got an article that he wants to share, he's genuinely curious, and this is really his life. So you've got it, Kyle. I'm really proud of you. It's your great passion, and based on what I'm showing, or what we're showing here, I'd say that love really comes through. It's been a true pleasure to see you progress in your work over the past 2 years. Kyle is actually currently showing at the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore, Maryland, as a second-time Sondheim Prize finalist. His first finalist prize was in 2014? Yes. And while he didn't take on the prize, I'm sure that this is just the first of many prizes that you will be eligible for over the course of your career. So, with that, we'll begin. I'll read their bios, and then we'll start with Kyle, and then we'll go to Rachel. Each of them will present for about 20 to 30 minutes, and then we'll hold questions until the very end. So, with that, we'll start with you, Rachel. Rachel Cordiola, born in 1985 in New York, New York, holds an MFA from the Maryland Institute College of Art in 2015 and a BFA from the Rhode Island School of Design. Cordiola is a 2016 Hamiltonian Fellow and a recipient of the 2017 Women at Work Air Gallery Summer Residency at the Governor's Island in New York. In fact, you'll be installing next week. So if you happen to be going to Governor's Island, go and give it a look. Her work has been exhibited in several group and solo presentations, including Light City, Baltimore, Maryland, School 33 Art Center in Baltimore, Making in Transit in Lumen, London, England. This word I'm not going to say, but she showed in Iceland. I can't pronounce it, so we'll just suffice it to say there are lots of syllables. Kvitz Gallery in Copenhagen, and of course, New Now at Hamiltonian Gallery. She was an artist in residence at the Arctic Circle Art and Science Expedition in Svalbard in 2016, Heima in East Iceland, the Vermont Studio Center, and the Atelier de Bisou in Marseille, France. She lives and works in Baltimore, Maryland. Kyle Tata holds a BFA from the Maryland Institute College of Art. He's a 2015 Hamiltonian Fellow and a two-time finalist for the Janet and Walter Sondheim Artscape Prize. Tata has an extensive local and regional exhibition history, including exhibitions at Hamiltonian Gallery, Area 405 in Baltimore, Sputnik Crescent Gallery in Chicago, Silvermine Art Center, New Canaan, Connecticut, the International Print Center, New York, Furthermore Gallery in D.C., Philadelphia Photo Art Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He's also a producer of small-scale publications, and his artist books are held in the collections of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, the International Center for Photography, and the Indie Photo Book Library in D.C. He works and lives in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks for everyone coming out tonight. Thanks to Amanda for that great intro. This is my second exhibition with second focus exhibition with Hamiltonian, so it's kind of crazy coming to the end of this, basically. And it's beyond words. It's been great for my art, and just to be able to spend the past 2 years with all the artists here and with all the staff. So say thank you, you guys. This has been fantastic. I'm going to start off my talk tonight with just a few slides of my previous exhibition here, my previous focus show, because I just want to show kind of how I got to the work that I'm making today that's around you and what has kind of changed my process since about 2 years ago. So these are a few slides from that show in way back in January 2016. And so the title of the show is called Asleep in the Factory, and for each of these photographs, I created these types of tableaus that were basically, they were kind of combined from a bunch of different darkroom manuals that I was collecting in my studio at the time, and it was a lot of like stock imagery of how to create exposures with like darkroom materials, how to properly use your camera. So I was kind of creating areas in my studios where they were in my studio where they're just kind of lying on top of each other, to a point where they looked like they were almost digital collages, but they were actually just physically laid on top of each other. And there was a lot of re-photographing that happened with this work. I would start with the images found in books, re-photograph it on like a 35mm camera, go back, shoot it with another type of camera. Until I finally had these kind of images that were purposely distorted and had different kind of artifacts in them, like from grain of the camera or kind of like the toner from a Xerox machine. And then I also combined that with different elements on there from different camera patents that I was collecting at the time as well. So whenever a camera invention is made, they have submitted a patent that describes what this invention is, submitted to the U.S. Patent Office. So those were combined with the stock imagery to create this kind of just kind of like collage of images. And I really wanted it to look like these images were just found like almost in someone's messy desk that worked at Kodak in the 60s or the 70s. I wanted the kind of laying of images to be almost happenstance. And with this too, I really wanted to play a lot with time and how you perceive these artifacts and what kind of time they exist in. Because while a lot of these images come from the 60s or the 70s, I was combining them with patents for even more contemporary-based photographic technologies, so there'd be next to a patent for like a digital camera. And then the way I was arranging them, I wanted it to purposely look like they had been doctored in Photoshop or that they had been physically manipulated so that people, when they were looking at it, would be kind of confused of the origin of them. Keeping with that, after that show, I continued with this idea of using the camera patents And they're just something that has always mystified me, because photography has this kind of sense where people think it's this dumb recording device, where that camera has no perceived notions of what that image is going to be like, and that's a completely objective image. But someone has to create these cameras, someone has to design them, design how the image captures. And a lot of times those designers come with their own kind of subjectivity to it. So even though it's something that people claim photography is a pure objective medium, it comes with all this baggage with it. It comes with the patent and the creation of it. So it's taking those patents and even manipulating them even more than I did with the previous work, where I would take them into Illustrator and really turn them into these more abstract patterns and really overlay a lot of them together. All these pieces are made with a vinyl cutter, cut vinyl directly onto a panel. It's a more of a detailed version of that one. And so with this, it was, you know, getting to a point in my work where I was pleased with the outcome with it, but at the same time, I was getting to a point, especially with, let me go back a little bit, with this work, where the subject matter was something that I was really focused on, but at the same time, when it all came said and done to this, I was capturing these images with a digital camera. And I definitely noticed that something was missing for myself with this, with the process. Something that I really enjoy about photography is that you can use a variety of processes with it, and that the process means so much in the final outcome of it, to the actual meaning of the artwork. And so I think that's where this work kind of fell short for myself, was that I wanted to really make it something that was a little bit more ubiquitous in how it was actually created. And there's a lot of contemporary photographers working today that I think really pushed like how the image is created and how you can have this really unique viewing experience with a photograph right in front of you. An artist I really admire is Liz Descend, and she makes photographic work that is really interesting because you have to be directly in front of the work to actually experience what it is. The gallery went to a show of hers in Boston last summer, and the show was fantastic. It was really phenomenal. The way that the pieces were laid out was very site specific. And they were very minimal, and you had to really be there to experience how these photographs reacted in the space, especially pieces like this one, where it was just like four pieces of photo paper that were toned a certain way that it really played with your perception, and how seeing a reproduction of this doesn't do any justice. It's really seeing this stuff in person that creates the work itself. From that show, I bought the catalog for it, and I was really excited after I bought the catalog, and then I just kind of got bummed out, because looking through the catalog, it was just like an image of green paper on the wall or something, and it was not the same experience of actually viewing the work in person. This is another shot from that show. And I really enjoyed how she made these, these standing pieces that are simply just a large piece of slide film lined up in a certain fashion. She really made those pieces feel monumental and really feel like they had so much physicality to them, even though they were so delicate. And it really made you consider yourself in that space. So these are things I'm thinking about a lot after my last show, and how to make that viewing experience a little bit more unique for the viewer in front of the work itself. Another artist that does this too is Phil Chang, and he has this series of work where they're all darkroom photographs that he doesn't completely fix. And so when he's showing them, they're just slowly fading in front of your eyes. And so they have all these tones and colors that are associated with darkroom photography that you really don't see ever, because it's the color of an unfixed piece of darkroom paper which you never really see in a dark room because the lights are so dim. And it really creates this, just like Liz designed, this really unique viewing experience. I'm realizing now that those are really tiny to see, so. And these two artists, too, I think they play a lot with kind of controlling visibility and how the viewers can actually see kind of these physical incarnations of photography. Another person that does that, that is someone that I think about a lot, is the artist Hito Steirel. And she, I think, is one of the most important artists, art writers of the past probably decade. And what I like so much about her is that she really makes a lot of work about these kind of like technical aspects in videography and photography that people often look over, but she really exposes how these elements are just used to keep your camera in focus or just used to create like a fill in video, how they have these really political connotations to them. This is from a show that she had a while back called How Not to Be Seen. And so she has these things displayed, like the chroma key green screen cards that obviously in videography that you kind of fill out to put whatever you want in that background. She also has that grid that you use to focus your video camera. She makes these large-scale sculptures also that just have these different contrast levels in them, and you really create them into these real physical objects. In addition, she made this video a while back for this exhibition that I remember watching, and it had a huge effect on how I think about photography and kind of contemporary culture. And the video is called How Not to Be Seen, and it's this really kind of tongue-in-cheek, kind of goofy video. It gets really meta. She talks about basically going through this whole list of multiple different ways that you cannot be seen by a video camera, and some of them are completely goofy, where she just like holds her hand in front of her face and she's like, I'm invisible to the camera. Then she has this whole part where she has assistants come out and they put on what she calls invisibility cloaks, and it's just a piece of green fabric that gets kind of chroma keyed out. But then she gets into these much more kind of darker aspects of this about how, you know, if you're not seen by society, and if you're invisible to society, there's so much you miss out on. At the same time, visibility is such an element of power in society. If people can see you, they can, you know, find out where you live, they can target you for certain things. And there's another slide from the video where she paints the chroma key paint onto her face and slowly disappears. But getting back to this like darker aspect of it, that whole video, as you can see back in this slide, that whole video takes place in the desert on this blacktop that has this printed focus map on it that's used to as a focus tool for videographers. This is an actual site that's out in like the, I think it's this New Mexico desert, and it's this large area that has multiple different blacktops with different focus grids printed on the blacktops, and they were created in the 60s for spy planes, so they could actually focus their cameras before they would go overseas for any missions. So these really kind of overlooked kind of design elements in photography and videography have these kind of darker aspects to it, and have much more of a political manner to them than just being, you know, a pure abstraction or a pure grid. And that kind of brought me to something that I've been collecting for a really long time in my studio, which is just these security tint envelopes. And they're just this like goofy thing that I just kept on collecting around because the patterning just looks really silly and abstract. But at the same time, they're printed on the inside of these envelopes, so you just simply, when you hold them up to a light, you can't see through them. And I just started thinking about how this is, you know, this abstraction is designed by someone for the sole purpose of not being able to see through it. And it's a design tool to control your vision. It's a design tool to control visibility. And what's interesting about these two is that someone designs these, and a lot of them have these kind of built... Oops. Uh-oh.
Oh, it's okay. You can just close that out.
Sorry. Right. Yeah. There we go. What's crazy about these is that they have these built-in glitches to them. Like, they're not purely just a grid. Sometimes there'll be different, like, distortions in them. The lines won't meet up right. And so I was really fascinated by the fact that someone has to go into those designs and make sure that line is just ever so out of place. So then that way it works better as this kind of cloaking device for someone's personal information. At the same time, too, that really made me think about, you know, this value that we associate to what's in these envelopes. You know, personal information is so... I was just really starting to think about how much value we associate to this information. This information that's inside these envelopes. And most of the time it's banking information or information regarding insurance or just any kind of personal information. And at the same time, being in my studio, listening to the radio a lot, I started hearing a lot about how different search engines are starting to sell people's personal search history, and it's just how it's becoming this completely come its own currency. That's not even people's information regarding their banks anymore. It's just like depending on what you search, you know, some company wants that because they want to know how much people are searching their product or what people are searching for, because it's becoming this thing that is leading to so much more commerce. So taking that kind of inspiration, I was taking these security tint envelopes, and basically the process that I used to create the work you guys are seeing now and some extra slides I'm going to show you in a minute was that I was taking these patterns and turning them into transparencies and putting them in my large format camera between the lens and the film plane so that it rests right on top of the film. So that for all these images, there's nothing projected on the people, and there's no Photoshop that happens afterwards. It all happens directly in camera with putting these security tint patterns in front of the film. It starts to act like a film mask. So doing like a double exposure or sometimes a triple exposure will create areas where the patterns are masking out certain areas of the film. So you get these kind of distortions that are really unique. At the same time, like I said before, it happens all within the camera and it happens all on the piece of film. So a lot of this stuff was pure chance operation. Like I could set up a lot of parameters of what was going to happen in the studio, but when the negative got developed, it was a huge surprise of what actually ended up where on the photograph. So I'm going to show you guys some of the early test shots I was doing with this. And like Amanda mentioned, I have another exhibition up right now at the Walters, the Sondheim Prize Finals Exhibition. And so there's a few in here I'm going to show you guys that are in that exhibition and not here. So this is one of the first tests I did with this process. And like I said before, it's really interesting how certain areas come through parts of the mask and what areas kind of disappear at the same time. And it's a completely up to chance. And shooting through these different screens, I was really intrigued about how with some of them, they almost act like a curtain between the viewer and the subject matter. It's almost like you're looking through this kind of distortion. And some of the other ones, they get really ingrained in the image itself. And I was really intrigued with that because this is really going back to my main kind of thesis with this project, because these patterns were created by some kind of corporation, some kind of, you know, faceless entity, that then it becomes completely intertwined with this person's physical identity. And relating this back to, I set up a lot of parameters and rules for myself to even, you know, stress more this kind of duality between the individual and these larger corporations and this kind of like doubling of yourself. So all the lighting that took place for each of these photographs, the color gels relate to the bank that each person belongs to. They relate to each kind of like corporate colors of each bank. Just as this other level of how you are completely entwined with this kind of corporate entity. In addition to, as you guys can see in some of the photographs here, I went back to a lot of them and physically etched areas on top of the plexiglass itself, because I wanted to create even more of this kind of layering of surfaces. And I also wanted to create this kind of doubt in the viewer. I think when people view these, they have a hard time just comprehending the physicality of them. A lot of people look at these during the opening and at the Walters are constantly trying to see if they can see through something. A lot of people think that like the black areas have to be some kind of like collage element on top of the photograph. So I liked creating that level of doubt with the viewer, with going back and etching on top of it just a little bit more, so people have this extra thing that they have to comprehend of where it lays in relation to the photograph. At the same time I was doing those, I'd started taking a bunch of photographs of these pre-owned currency trays that I was buying off of eBay and Amazon, and just got into a really deep hole at some point in the studio with commerce and economics and how we attribute value to these things. And these currency trays I just found to be this other kind of fascinating object, because they only really have value when they're holding something else, and their whole existence is just to hold something else. Just to hold money in a bank or in a store somewhere. But when they don't have anything in there, you can buy them off of Amazon for $3. and they just become these kind of like strange forms that are just alien once they're taken out of a cash register. And so taking those in my studio, I started trying to photograph them in a similar fashion to the portraits, and trying to really abstract the way that they were located, and trying to, you know, portray them in a way that would make them even more foreign to the viewer, so you wouldn't have any kind of relationship with this object, not even know how it would hold something else. That's it for me.
My name's Rachel, and I'm a first-year Hamiltonian artist. I came here as an interdisciplinary artist working mostly in lens-based technology. So in the last, I graduated from MICA in 2015 from the Mount Royal Interdisciplinary Program, and then moved to New York, where I was working at the New York Botanical Garden. I quit that job and went to the Arctic from September 2016 to January 2017. So during this time, I was partially on a ship and part of a crew. And a lot of people asked me, like before and after I went, where actually were you? So the Arctic Circle, everyone thought Antarctica, which it was not Antarctica. So the Arctic Circle is an area that stretches. And I was in an island called Svalbard. If you're Danish, if you are German, it's known as Spitsbergen. And that's kind of like a back and forth they have. And I was also in Iceland, in East Iceland, in a town called Seyðisfjörður, which is the original landing site for the Vikings. And it's actually very isolated. You have to take a plane to get out there. And it was also winter time, so pretty treacherous. So when I first landed in Svalbard, it's you might have heard of the International Seed Bank. This is the location for the International Seed Bank, which had some kind of flood maybe a month ago. You can't actually go inside, but that's where it's located, and that houses all of the seeds, different strains of seeds that no longer exist. In case the world were to come to an end, we'd be able to grow food because of this station right here. And then in Iceland, this is a little photograph of the town that I was living. So I'm going to show some photographs of this trip, which actually I haven't really shown to anyone before, just to give a little background to the installation here. So this is Svalbard. Let's see. Which is basically an icy desert landscape. I'm going to play you a sound. Sound of a glacier falling. While I was there, I collected kind of like an encyclopedia of sounds to the different locations. Svalbard was originally colonized, well, during an era of exploration, but inhabited mostly for coal mining. So a lot of, and the coal mining there doesn't really sustain the people anymore, so there's a lot of remnants of past decades of work and people that lived there, but pretty desolate at this point in time. So that's the guides that we were with. You can't actually travel without a guide because there's polar bears there. And they're actually just, we're in a boat and they're screaming large ice block in Danish so that we can steer the boat away from the ice and not tip over. And I'm just going to go over a few of the different things that happened during this period of time that kind of led the way for the installation here. One was this day hike. We went to the top of a mountain, and it overlooks this one glacier. And this area, Svalbard, was originally located along the equator billions of years ago, if you go back through geologic history. And in the depths of the landscape are actually prehistoric trees. So I spent a lot of time in this landscape that was completely desolate, like an ice desert, but thinking a lot about the layers of time and what it could have looked like before this tropical forest that is now kind of like an icy wasteland. And then as you're moving through the landscape, you also find remnants of people and animals from the past. So this area of the world, there were a lot of trappers, so seal trappers, fishermen that would go out into the wilderness for extended periods of time, often completely isolated, alone. Some didn't come back. And these areas are similar to Alaska as well, where you have hunters' cabins, where basically what they are refuges for people that are out working in the landscape. And they're kind of known about by word of mouth. So if you're caught out, you're working, you're caught out in the landscape, you have a place to have safe overnight, so you're not freezing outside. And if you go into these hunter or trapper cabins, it's decades and decades and decades of time pass. Everyone leaves like a note or like a can of beans from like the 1950s or something from the past, and it all kind of stays as is. So they're kind of like these time capsules. And communication becomes like really key when you're out completely isolated. So here's a picture of a trapper's cabin that we came across. And then this is a print from back in the day. The original explorers that found the island were actually looking for a passage into China and found the Arctic and Svalbard instead. The first winter that they spent there, they hid out in this cabin, and this print kind of encapsulates what these trapper cabins are. It's kind of hard to see that image. So when we were on board, there was a writer who really wanted to go out into the middle of the night and see this trapper cabin. So there were a few guards that went with the writer, and a way for all the artists to participate is we were on the deck with the captain in the captain's little cabin, and they relayed back to us what they were seeing and experiencing as they were entering into the cabin. So I made a bunch of sketches, and this was kind of like a call and response, so a text or verbal-based relay to an image-based, based on like verbal communication, but also what you would imagine was there. And here, these are just some quick sketches from my notebook, and then at the end, they lit all their flashlights off and did like a relay symbol back to the ship. So being someone that works between a studio or a city and then these extreme landscapes, there's a dialect between finding solace in isolation and coming back to society, and this back and forth that you're constantly trying to deal with. And I found this poem. It's an unknown author, and you can really read a few of the words really quick, but this fisherman explained back in the day to a younger fisherman what it's like to be in the city and be warm and inside of a people, but still have this drive to go out and be isolated in the landscape, and the feeling of going back and forth. Which is kind of like encapsulating the lives of these hunters and these trappers. So then there's the question of terra incognita, and what it means is an unknown land. So in all of my artwork, you'll find that whether it's characters or it's a landscape, they're all landscapes that are neither present nor future. They usually don't have humans. So they're spaces that are unknown landscapes. And they'll usually go out into these extreme environments to kind of get spaces where you can't identify time markers or places or things where you can identify where they're from. And terra incognita is a word that was originally used in map making. On the bottom you can see it says terra incognita, and these were words or also exemplified by mythological creatures on old maps that would symbolize areas where it was the unknown. So this is a print from the first explorers. And then I don't know if you can see really small, there is a polar bear right there. An unidentified creature. This is actually a whale. And the polar bear was actually circling the whale. So this was a really jam-packed period of time traveling. It was very active, very exhausting. And then after 3.5 weeks, I was then in Iceland in Seyðisfjörður. And this was a few month period of kind of contemplation. So I was thinking about processing images, video of this experience, traveling in the wilderness. And I began to make a series of installations. This is one I built in this closet space of almost like a fantastical greenhouse. Oops.
It's definitely time for a laptop upgrade. I was just complaining about this today. I hope this works out, Rachel. I'm sorry.
Fantastical greenhouse. Okay, so here's a picture of that. And during this time, I sent out an email inquiry. I was thinking a lot about different things that I was hearing on the news that were happening at home politically, and me being this completely cut off, isolated landscape there in Iceland. There are no predators there. So you can go out into the landscape for hours on end and just explore. So that's really how I spend a lot of my time, going out and photographing and doing video work outdoors, and then coming back in the day. And I sent out this email inquiry to a collective of people who probably had not heard from me in a while, of all ages, backgrounds, different career type. Asking them if they could explain to me their idea of paradise. And I received multiple responses over a few month period of time. And it was really interesting getting this survey. A lot of people had really similar imagery from different countries, from different age groups, that I could kind of put together into different categories, either some occurrence of a celestial body, the sun, the moon, or horizon, some body of water, some kind of natural, whether it's a plant or forest or a mountain, some outdoor space, sometimes a loved one, a family member, or a friend, and then other significant imagery that jumped out at me or was maybe really particular to that person and really individual, I also made note of. So these are some of the emails I received back, and The installation is a collection of the responses. So on the wall in the back, there are 30 responses. And then each response has some kind of imagery that's referenced in the installation. So the installation is kind of a collective of these ideas and memories about this word. So when I was receiving the responses, I was kind of color coding them and finding common themes and things that would reoccur to kind of gauge a hierarchy of how I would feature them into the installation. I thought this one was pretty funny because I got it towards the end and they listed almost every single category in the one response that was really short and really simple. And then this one at the end is my favorite. I'll just read it. And this one is anonymous, although I know who it's from. I am an optimistic person, and in the past I would have easily come up with something akin to the writings of Blake and the relationship of man to nature. But now, after this election, with the total disregard for global warming, with smug maternal extremism negatively affecting lives, and with the crazy violence in this world always cloaked with justifications, I am at a loss to even approach this word. It's almost like a word is hidden as archaeology, and I'm afraid I won't be able to find it again. So that statement is actually associated with a plaster cast of the prehistoric tree hidden in the sand back there. So each statement has some kind of symbol represented in the installation, and that response kind of summed up kind of the different feelings that were happening and are still happening, and being completely isolated out in the wilderness in this kind of last unknown landscape. It was a strange feeling to be having. So when I was making this installation, I also couldn't do it in my studio. I would spend a lot of time going around trying to find these specific objects, and I just made a lot of sketches of what it would be, plants that I would get, and how it would fit together, and kind of put it together on site. And I do a lot of photography, so I took some images in my studio that are also similar to Kyle's process, where you're doing 35 millimeter color images, and then by doing multiple exposures on the film, rewinding it and bring it back, the color separations using gel, so red, green, and blue gels combining to create the colors in the color spectrum, and then by layering them in the camera, creating different colors and kind of abstracting the images. So these are just little installations in my studio of the plants. And the layering of the film, which are similar to what's happening with the colored lights back there, so combining the different lights together for color mixing. My work has a very fantastical element to it, I would say. I'm really inspired by a lot of science fiction writing and literature. Like science fiction writing and literature also often have political undertones or reference to other ideas that are not inherent but seen through these alternate landscapes, whether it's a future landscape or a reflection of a past landscape. So I find a lot of inspiration through that. And I also noticed when I was putting this together, they all have a figure in them, which references a whole other line of conversation. But thinking also a lot about, in my other work, The Last Terra Incognita is like the outer space. So what that really means for us and at this point in time. And one other thing that really influenced this installation is this excerpt from, this is kind of nerdy, from Dune, which is a sci-fi novel. And if anyone's read it, there's a point in the book where Lady Jessica, who is the Empress, She is located in a planet where there virtually is no water in the future. And she is the Empress, and she finds tucked in their castle that there is this biome, this greenhouse that is a secret greenhouse, and it has flowing water. And in the chapter, it's her inner her experiencing this and never seeing this ever, and then her inner dialogue about wanting to stay there, but also her power to see the future, and her inner conflict of wanting to stay in this utopia, but knowing she has to return to this desert landscape, which is infused with all kinds of political agendas. And something I'm kind of planning for the future is to actually build my own greenhouse in my studio. So in the Arctic, you do have periods of extreme darkness and then extreme light. So and very small population. So one thing that people are starting to do there is create these geodesic domes, which would produce food that would be able to feed a small village or a small town. And these are using grow lights indoors for part of the period of darkness where you can't grow food and you can't grow outside because it's freezing. And then the other half of the year where you have sunlight all day. So I'm going to be building one of these in my studio and creating a functioning greenhouse and then shooting a series of new videos for probably the next exhibition. And that's it.
Data, because it is so deeply ingrained in everything we do now. I think it's more about being conscious about it and knowing it exists, because I think that so many people are just so unaware of the fact that people are buying up other people's information. A really good example of this is I'm doing the thing I hate at Artist Talk right now, which is talk about today's political climate, which I go to artist talks not to hear about that, but this last year's election, the Trump campaign used a company called Cambridge Analytica that specifically targeted people based on their Facebook posts and based on their Facebook likes to specifically target specific ads and stories in specific parts of the country so that people in red states would see more anti-Hillary stuff and they would see all the stuff that you wouldn't be seeing in a different state. And that's like a huge thing, and that's like barely reported on. That was like, I remember reading that story last year on something like on Bloomberg or something, and like it wasn't covered by anyone else. And I think people now are starting to realize how important it is. And I guess if anyone can get away with anything from my work, is relating to that, it's just that this stuff is really important and it is so ingrained to the images.
The colors in there, there's a series of, sometimes I'll use gels, like in photographs I'll use gels, but the red, green, and blue, when you combine them together, they mix to make all the colors in the spectrum, so by putting them in there, it kind of abstracts the space and breaks it up to create more of a more immersive experience for the viewer, and that's something I do a lot across a lot of my different work, so photo-based work, video work, to create illusionary spaces, or to create spaces where you can't really see the distance, or to break up a plane. So there's a lot of mirrors in there, mirrors on the floor, or mirrors propped up in different ways to kind of create this feeling of natural space that's kind of taking over. The connection is more about being in isolation, I would say, than the colors of the landscape. It's about the dialect, about being in the extreme landscape, an unknown landscape, an uninhabited landscape, and then that not really actually existing on Earth anymore. So having this back and forth, and that being kind of my paradise. And then trying to find out what other people think about that, and kind of this overall theme about wilderness and our relationship to wilderness, I feel like it is like a constant back and forth between humanity and natural space, so there's that underlying theme as well. But yeah, the colors in the installation are not referenced from the colors in the Arctic. Why not go to the Arctic? It was this thing. I went for the Arctic. I was there for 3 weeks in Svalbard, and then I was in Iceland until from October to January. So more like half the year, but still a pretty extended period of time. I guess in my work and in my life in the past, I've also had periods where I've lived in other extreme landscapes. I've lived in the Sub-Sahara for over 2 years, which is also a desolate kind of wasteland, but it's a desert. It's a hot desert. It's not an ice desert. So these types of spaces are often the sites for my photo or video work, to create these spaces where you can't really identify the time of the place, whether it's something from the past or something that will be in the future. And there's usually there's an absence of humans, usually. On my Iceland trip, I began doing another series of work where there are characters, and I started inhabiting these characters that would be from another planet or would be discovering another planet, or possibly the Earth in the future. But I find that these spaces are spaces where you can see or contemplate past periods of time. You can visually see it in the strata. And then there are also places where they are kind of uninhabitable, so they're kind of these perfect settings for my work. So I go to great lengths, and I also enjoy being outdoors and being active, so it's a way for me to engage with the technology. So I'll also often use the camera as a way to explore, often in the first-person perspective, that will then allow the viewer to connect also with that experience of navigation.
Just something that I noticed while you both were speaking was that human connection, meaning that I know in your work, Kyle, the last two shows have sort of been like finding the human error in a mechanical process, and I think that that's still very much a part of this work as well. Like, if you look hard enough, you'll find the error, or the human in the midst of the grid. And then in your case, Rachel, it's interesting that the project really originated from people, and then it's devoid of them. I guess I'd be curious to know what your interest or your relationship is with the human presence in your work, respectively.
I have to be honest, this is the first time I've extensively photographed people like that. And it was like something that... I think looking back after my last focus show here, I always saw myself as this much more kind of abstract type of photographer. And looking at that type of work, I realized that I was just taking so many photos of people. And even like being critical of myself, realizing that like I don't know why I needed to have that extra separation between it. And that it was doing something, it was causing this extra layer that I didn't need. And so I thought that I definitely needed to have actual people in these photographs. And I actually had to push myself to create that type of work. I picked specific people too for these photographs of people I knew pretty well, because I wanted to have that kind of tension of photographing someone that you're really intimate with, but between these layers of abstraction. And you know so much about these people, but after you have these elements in front of the film, that it becomes much more obscured, and they become much more abstracted by these designs that are created by other people.
I think it's not so much about people, but the human condition and the relationship of humans to the idea of wilderness, and if we're able to actually comprehend it. So by thinking about the past, or going to places where you can see the past, or the past has been unchanged in the landscape, it's kind of pushing the ability to understand geological time or understand the evolution of the Earth, to experience that and contemplate that. It's more about that than the actual people, but our human relationship and ideas to natural space.
I think something too, Rachel, after hearing you talk more about your work, I think something that I definitely relate to with my work is this kind of limitation of photography and limitation of lens-based media, where like you're showing those photographs of the iceberg and of like an unidentified creature in the water. And there's so much, I'm so interested in this kind of limitation of it, where you can show this example in front of people of like, this is what the landscape looks like, but at the same time it tells you nothing.
Yeah, and I think both of us come from a photographic background where you read and think a lot about theory, where the camera represents something that captures the real, but you're able to manipulate it in a way that it would create an alternate history or obscure something based on the relationship of a sequence or the position of one shape to another. So you're looking at something that is from reality, but it could be completely constructed by the artist. So that's something to play with between like a document or, and fiction that I think we're both doing.
Any more questions? I think the last thing that I will say is that I'm really intrigued by this notion of hoping to create a psychological or emotional state, because I think, especially in your work, Rachel, you're trying to transport people to a state of mind, and it's interesting that nature became the through line with which people were able to achieve, like, that's the way that they were able to access a feeling of peace and serenity. And I don't know, I guess that's not really a question, but it's interesting that that's where we go when we think about a state of paradise, really. And I guess in a lot of ways, Kyle, I'm seeing you do the same thing, where you're sort of presenting the limitations of how we can represent that, I don't know, like a tension or the limitations of what, these are so much about encountering the physical object, and really for both of you, it's about experiencing it in the real. It's not about reproducing something digitally, even though that may be where you started or how you access the information, but it's about being physically present for both of you. Thank you both very much. And, audience, Rachel is still gathering definitions of paradise, so if you would like to contribute yours, the panel is open. There's a little box where she's got a collection of them, so please feel free to contribute. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.